You're listening to Stand Out with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8pm here on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you all well on this Wednesday evening, and I hope you all had a great Halloween, whatever you get up to, and I hope you're all keeping well. And I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Fergus Farrell. Fergus knows what it means to hit rock bottom and what it takes to rise again. After a life-altering workplace accident in 2018, left him paralysed from the waist down, Fergus was told he would never walk again. But through relentless determination, emotional honesty and refusal to be defined by limitation, he walked out of the National Rehabilitation Hospital in Dublin, and he done a challenge walking 206 kilometres across Ireland not too long after. Sit back and enjoy the show. Fergus, thanks a million for joining me today. I'm delighted to have the chance to talk to you. We've been chatting for a while over Instagram and stuff, so I'm delighted to see you. How are things?
Yeah, all good. Yeah, it's great to be on, Ian. I really appreciate the opportunity to, you know, share the story with somebody like yourself, you know, who obviously has a pretty unique story himself.
And like we were saying, we have similar stories. We were both in the matter and the NRH and stuff, so it'll be good to talk to someone, I suppose, that knows what it's like. I always ask my guests at the start, Fergus, I suppose, growing up, were you Galway man originally, are you?
Yeah, so I was born in a town called Athenry. I'm sure you heard of the fields of Athenry. My dad was a farmer, and we sold fruit and veg and stalls around Galway City and County. So, like, a really lovely upbringing. Like, it was hard, but it was lovely, you know.
Did you, what kind of sports? I know rugby obviously was in your life, but from a young age, did you play any other?
Yeah, so I would have played hurling, a lot of hurling when I was younger. And I didn't have the skill sets for it. You know, I was put in full forward to catch the ball and try and put the ball in the back of the net. But outside that, I was pretty useless at it. So I fell into rugby just because it was on a Saturday morning, and a few mates started going to it and they told me about it. And I ended up going, and you know, obviously I was a big young lad, so my skill sets suited ideally. And after that, then I just loved it. I loved everything about it. And then sure, I went into soccer. I played a lot of soccer as well, I was better suited to both sports than hurling. I just didn't have the skill sets for hurling.
Yeah. No, I did. I played a bit of hurling as well before.
My did accident, you?
But yeah. But football. All right. Football would have been my main one, I suppose. I kind of enjoyed it when I was tall and stuff.
And who was you playing with?
I played a bit of hurling with Crokes because they were the only hurling team really around my area. But I played football with Spa. They'd have been my main club. They're right beside my house. So I kind of just played the hurling because Crokes were the only around at the time. But I played a bit of rugby as well, but I didn't stick at that for too long. I went back to the football. Did you enjoy school, or were you kind of like myself? Did you rather be outside with a ball at your hands?
Yeah, I wasn't very academically bright, you know, for to say the least. My parents would have sent me into Yates College to do a lead cert just so I'd actually pass it, not to succeed, but just so I'd pass the lead cert. And it worked, but no, I was definitely not academic. I just wanted to play sports every waking moment. And my mates, my younger out with all, just wanted to play sports, you know. So, I also grew up in a time when Athenry were All-Ireland champions 5 years and 6 years. They're All-Ireland champions 5 times in 6 years. And a lot of my mates would have played in that team. So, like, as I grew up, a lot of my mates were very successful county hurlers and stuff like that. So, I had something to kind of, I seen their success. I wanted their success, but in the rugby field. So that took me on massively, you know. But because of that, then academically, I just tried to answer them.
And I think that's important as well, Fergus. And I've said it on a lot of interviews here. Just because you don't enjoy school, like, doesn't mean that, you know, there's nothing out there you can do. Like, these days, you can get into things later, can't you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it doesn't define you in any shape or form. Like, if you think about it, how many people go to college in the first year, they give up or stop trying because they've realized they've picked out something that they know nothing about, they're not going to enjoy. So, look at people think college is the start of their lives. It's not really, you know, it's not. I don't know how many people actually end up working outside of what they are trained to do, because ultimately they discover that it's not for them. No, and I'm definitely in that bracket. I did go to college for like I'd say about three, four months, but I think I only went to about 10 lectures.
Really?
You know? Yeah, and for this, I have three kids, and one of them told me they don't want to go to college. I fully support it.
Absolutely, no, 100% agree with you. I suppose after then, I suppose you kind of working after sport and stuff. I suppose we'll move on to your accident now in a minute. But
yeah.
What were you doing there, kind of leading up to the accident? Then what work were you kind of involved in?
Well, I went into the business world, so kind of when sport kind of came, you know how to say, I knew it wasn't going to be a career for me anymore. I was getting too fat, too lazy. Enjoyed socializing too much. Ultimately, my dad was in the taxi business, and he'd been, you know, a lot of people my dad had moved into the taxi business. He kind of, fireman, he couldn't make a living out of fireman, so he moved into that. And, you know, people were asking for like larger vehicles. I ended up going out buying a bus, and I went into the bus and coach industry. And then I put my head, I like that in sports, I put absolutely every inch of my into it. And I look at it, I did develop it into a pretty large company, 3.7 million turnover, certified coaches. And I enjoyed it because I enjoyed the challenge of the business. When I look back now, did I actually enjoy the coach business? Probably not. I enjoyed the challenge of it. Probably not. I don't think it was a very nice community. I don't think it was a very nice industry. But I just got so brave into it, I didn't know any difference.
And like you said there, you kind of moved on from it. I know, doing a bit of research, I read up that visualization was always kind of a big part of your life, even before your accident, was it?
Yeah, it was a massive part of my life. And I've looked into a lot more and realized that everything I do with my life is I visualize everything. I don't even realize I'm doing it half the time, you know what I mean? But like, so far was sake, when I was playing rugby, I remember visualizing being the Keith Woods who would run around the front of my green with the ball under my arm, you know, visualizing that I was Keith Woods with the green jersey on and running around the rugby pitch, and John Alumo as well. I used to visualize, you know, when I wanted to own my first new bus, I visualized owning my first new bus. But there's so many other things, like, you know, I'm a very visual person. So using visualization actually came second nature to me without even knowing it.
I'd have been the same. Even in school, I'd always learn better by seeing something instead of like
Yeah.
listening. Would you?
Yeah, I'm the exact same. So like, if somebody shows me how to, you know, somebody showed me how to hang a curtain, if they show me, I do it straight away. If somebody tried to explain it to me, or they could explain it to me 20 times, I still wouldn't get it. You know, once I was shown something, or once I took part in something, I'd never forget it. And even when it comes to directions, when I'm driving around the country, I actually don't learn the name of the towns or learn the roads or anything like that. I'd see something that would remind me, oh, after this, I turn left. Oh, after this, I turn right. Everything's visual. You know, so that's just who I am. You know, that's how I learn. That's how I, you know, inform myself.
What did you, when you were playing sport, and I like to ask people that I interview that do play sport, playing sport, I suppose, at youth level, what did sport teach you about not even just teamwork, but I suppose discipline and pressure and stuff like that?
First of all, the biggest learning I had, it taught me respect. Respect for authority, respect for my elders, respect for people who had more knowledge. It taught me those three big things. And that's, I still hold those massively close to my chest these days. But also taught me a lot about discipline, you know, how to apply yourself and how to remain disciplined, you know. And again, that's taught me very, very well throughout the years. And one big thing that it taught me also was when I went through my recovery, I used what I use when I wanted to train hard to make the better levels. I just applied the exact same thing when I was lying flat in my bed. So it taught me how to push myself harder. Just taught me that, you know.
And that is important. And like you said, it still
yeah.
kind of sticks with you to this day.
Yeah.
Bring me back, I suppose, to the day of the accident, I know, like you said, you moved into the kind of transport business. 2018,
Yeah.
gonna bring me back to the, I suppose, the day that your life changed forever.
So that day, basically, it was just a normal day, nothing unusual, nothing more than lack of sleep the night before. Got up, started work around the yard because always there's 101 things to do, and but I went in to just change my clothes in my house. I was next door. We were living in my old grandmother's house while we were building our new house, and put on my white shirt, black pants, and came out in the yard. And when I had 15 minutes to spare. I couldn't, like that. I should have just sat down and had a coffee with Vincent in the office, or like Sean out in the yard. But I just couldn't. I couldn't waste that 15 minutes. So I seen a rustic bench in the yard that I thought somebody was going to reverse into late at night and cause me a whole head of grief. While I was up in Belfast with my rugby group, that I'd have to make 101 phone calls to rectify the problem that would have been caused by this person reversing into. So this is all like, this is stuff I was preempting. I was thinking this was what was going to happen. So I decided to move the bench, and I called over Sean, and I lifted her away from my body because I was a white shirt. I didn't want to get my shirt dirty. And took maybe carried it for 10 or 15 meters, and I ultimately dropped it because I got this all merciful pain up through my back. And when I dropped it, it was a pain I never felt before. Like I'd broken bones before, I'd torn ligaments before, I'd think, I'd reconstruction surgery in my shoulder, all these different type of things. This was just a different pain altogether. And I'd actually had a hip replaced as well at this stage. So I remember looking on the ground. I didn't want to show pain because Sean was there. I didn't want to show weakness because that's, what men kind of do. And eventually, after 10 or 12 really long, deep breaths, the pain, I won't say went, but it subsided enough that I could stand up. And then I picked up that bench one more time. I took a step with it and bang. It was like somebody put a shotgun to the middle of my back and pulled the trigger, and a huge explosion. The next thing, I find myself on the ground and roaring, absolutely roaring in pain. Didn't know such pain could exist. And ultimately, the bench was on top of me. I couldn't feel it. And next thing I realized, I couldn't move my legs. They were underneath me. And next thing, just that horrific pain engulfed me, which, stayed with me right through until, I was knocked out for the operation, which was like 7 or 8 hours later, whatever it was,
And it is a frightening thing, like when the legs from under you, like the feeling. It's hard to describe to somebody, isn't it?
It's impossible. I do try and describe it, but there's no way of describing it. How can you get somebody to understand you cannot connect with your feet, yet they're actually attached to you?
Did you have any of the kind of feeling like that? Because when I had my accident, I was like to my friend, I said, "Is my leg behind my head?" It's like your legs are in a totally different place.
Exactly. Like, well, so I had my, I don't know, are you a complete
Complete. Yeah, yeah.
car? So mine was 90%. That was the difference, So I had mine was horrific sore at the nerve pain because it was like my nerve endings were all trying to reattach. So my sore, most of my concentration was on pain because I couldn't get a breath. Like I was just roaring. So it was after riding, when I say a while, it might have been 3 or 4 minutes when I realized my legs were underneath me and I couldn't move them. And even that, my concentration was more on the pain because I just couldn't stop roaring. So I think we're in terms of, what really got me was when I went to touch myself and I couldn't feel myself touching me.
That was the real indicator, was it?
Yeah. When I was here going, I could see my hand touching my quad. Why am I feeling this? And like, yourself, Ian. Like, it's impossible to describe that sensation, that feeling. It's just impossible. You can't,
It is. No, it's impossible.
unless you've been there, yeah, it's just impossible.
And from there, you went to the, I know you were in the NRH, because I
Yeah.
wanted to ask you, you were in the matter beforehand, were you?
Yeah, it was a matter for, I think, 8 or 9 days. So what happened to myself is obviously you're rushed up there for hospital. I end up getting huge clots in my lungs, so I had to be going to the intensive care unit for
Boy,
two or
really?
three days. Yeah, for 2 or 3 days. I was meant to get down within 6 days, I think it was, and then literally the day before I came down, I started struggling massively in the bed. I don't know. Did you have this? Did you You obviously had, two people come in and move you onto your side for 2 hours and move you onto your back for the other 2 hours and move you onto the, so you wouldn't get the bed sores.
Relieving the pressure,
Yeah. Well, I was in the exact same situation. And then the day before, I was told I was about to be moved to St. Finbarr's in Galway. And the day beforehand, I started struggling just to breathe. I mean, but nobody was paying any heed to me. I was here going, I'm worse. I'm getting really bad here. And then my ex-wife came in, and I told her I'm really struggling here, and she was a midwife, so she knew how to read all these instruments. And the next thing, she started looking at my blood oxygen levels, and they dropped massively.
Away.
And and that's when they discovered that I had blood clots in my lungs, not close to my lungs, but in my fucking lungs.
Go
And I
away.
mean, there was a panic session. I mean, within 3 or 4 minutes, there was 10 people around me. And that was actually more frightening than an accident,
It's very
because I was
daunting,
now,
isn't it?
yeah, because I was now in an act in a place where people knew in my condition, but yet they were panic. I could see the panic in their faces. So that to me was more actually, and that was obviously me thinking, "Oh, don't tell me this is something else I'm going to have to be putting up with." In mind, at this stage, I was told I was paralyzed for life. Well, good luck, lights out, unfortunately. So that was here going, don't tell me this is one of these things that you have to deal with a constant basis of being a spinal cord injury.
And like you said there, you were in a place where you expected everybody to know already what was wrong. And then when you see the people that you think know everything, when the panic sets into them, it's then you're going to say, "Oh Jesus, lads, I'm in a place here that I'm supposed to not feel I kind of scared around these people, isn't it?"
I thought I should feel safe there, and I didn't. At that moment, anyways, that's for sure.
And I suppose moving on, before you went to the rehab, was it in Dunleary or in the Mat, or you one night your toe you
No,
kind
that
of
was that was down St. Finbarr's 21 days later. I said, never forget it. Yeah, it's half fortnight or half 2 a night happened. I'll just never forget it. It's one of those moments. Again, I tried to describe it, but I said, I moved my toe, but when I moved my toe, I couldn't feel myself moving my toe because I still, like, I don't have feelings in my feet. So, it's very hard to describe somebody moving something but not knowing if you moved it, because you can barely see it, number one, and number two is you can't feel it. So, it was a bit of a serene moment because I really didn't know whether I was actually moving it or was I losing it. Yeah, so it was, again, really, like, it was obviously a very a great moment for me. But for 4 hours, while I waited until somebody came into me, I was gone cracked.
And when the nurse came in, then when that happened, was it long after before you got to go to Dunleary? Were you in St. Finbarr's for
Yeah,
long?
so I don't know how long you had to wait in for, but I was 16 to 18 weeks, so it's a waiting time. But because now I had movement, I got actually in within 10 weeks.
Go away,
Oh,
really.
exactly. Yeah, so that even that 6 to 8 weeks of laying redundant, I think served me really, really well, because now I was going up to a hospital whereby they were going to push me as hard as I possibly could, And I think that if I was another 6 or 8 weeks of being redundant in the St. Finbarr's, I don't think I would have come out as well, So that was a massive help in my recovery.
'Cause Fergus, I was thinking my accident was in 2017, and I was in the mat for 4 months. Then I went out to Dunleary at January 2018. So we wouldn't have been awfully far apart.
Jeez, no. Oh yeah. So when did you leave? When did you leave the NRH?
I remember I came off the ventilator just before Christmas of 2018. And I went out on the 1st of January, the first week in January, to Dunleary, and I was there for 5 months. So we must have been close enough time-wise.
Yeah, so you left kind of around September, is that right? September 2018.
It would have been around then, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I would have got in. I got in just the week or two before Christmas. Or was it a week before Christmas? Something along that line. So only a couple of months, really. Yeah.
It's only
Jesus.
when I was doing a bit of reading and I saw the date that yours was. I
Yeah.
was like, geez, they're not too far apart.
No. So you remember Colum and Mick and
Colm.
They're brilliant lads, all fairness.
How important do you think people like the nurses and carers, even the physios and stuff, apart from away from the, I suppose, job that they do, whether it be helping or even the physios doing the physio, just the one-on-one human connection?
Well, I'll tell you a good one, right? When I was in there, and I was only in there a few days, and I was in the wheelchair, and I remember my slipper fell off my foot, and I was struggling to put it on. So I waited for Mick, who I didn't really know at the time, to come my way, and I got a nod at him and said, "Would you come here and put on my slipper for me?" You know, I didn't, like, you know. And he did. He hunkered down and he started putting on his slipper to me. But as he put on my slipper, he looked up at me and said, and he goes, "Now, Fergus, this is a rehabilitation hospital, not a nursing home." He said, "You're here to improve, not for me to do everything for you." And I tell you,
That's
this was from that
important.
moment onwards, it turned my mindset. I said, "Right, I'm going to do it. Anything that's difficult, I'm going to do it as hard as I can, because it's going to make, because he's right. I'm there to improve. I'm there to do a job." And it was like that was within 2 days of being in the place, like, you know. So without him saying that, I probably would have let other people do a lot of things for me, which would have served me absolutely no purpose.
So
So
that
that's how that's what
was.
I'm just saying, like, you know, how critically important those lads were. And I remember I went over to Stoke Mandeville, you know, for the Nationals games. And so anyways, when I was over there, no, I have to say I thought it was a bad experience. Because the whole idea going over there was to feel like, you know, that we're just as valued people as anybody else's. But I found it completely opposite. But I remember this guy, I was going over and I took part in all the games, but I gave up after a while because as a person who played sports at a good level, I found it very, how to say it? I found it very, oh, what's the word she was? I actually found it very bad treatment. I thought they treated us like second class citizens. I tell you, they wouldn't be fine. Like, we're over there to compete, and they're giving us fries in the morning before you're going out to compete. They didn't give you a timetable, so you're like an hour waiting for your next game to play, but you weren't allowed to go anywhere because you could be 5 minutes time or it could be an hour time. That wouldn't happen in professional sports. That wouldn't happen in under 12 soccer, but they were doing it to us because, you know, we're in a wheelchair. So I found it extremely difficult. Now others were enjoying it, but I ended up saying I just gave up.
And
I didn't bother anymore.
when you
Yeah,
were
I was
playing,
there to compete and to win, and I wanted every opportunity to do that. But I just gave it up. And when Cullum, who was with me, seen me, he kind of ground the tools at me, and myself and himself went off to the pub together to talk about it. But
boy.
like that's the human aspect that they had. You know what I mean? The scene I was struggling. But they weren't going to leave me alone, and either.
Did you get to go down to Baker's Corner?
Yeah, we went down to Baker's Corner on Thursday evening. Yeah, brilliant, wasn't
I'd say that place gets some business from the rehab.
I know, yeah, unbelievable, isn't it?
How important were I suppose friends and family and stuff during the time, I suppose, while you were going through all this?
I look at they're so important, you know. Now, more important when I got home, to be honest with you. Because when I was up in NRH, I was very determined and very driven. But saying that again, I absolutely loved absolutely everybody who came up to, you know, who went out of the way to come up and, you know, say hello to me and to help me pass the evening sometimes. And people came out of the woodwork that I would never thought I would have come out of the woodwork, you know. And there's also people who I thought would have helped who didn't. But look, we're all on different journeys in our lives. But and also the people who came up to bring me home for the weekends, so my wife wouldn't have to do that, like, incredible. But for me, the most important part was when I got home, when I struggled most. I struggled massive when I fell off the edge when I got home. And
Mental.
then her I was there to do a job. I had peers, We're in a facility that we're used to people with disabilities. You know, it was all that. And I was improving. But I got home, I fell off the edge big time. You
Mentally
know,
wise.
so mentally wise, yeah. Like physically, I was still thriving. I was still imp like I did come out off my two I did come out of the NRH on my 2 feet. I mean, no, I stumbled out through the doors. Like I wasn't anywhere near walking as such, but I stumbled out through the doors. But when I got home, I still was like I was still making huge gains. I was still going to the gym, but everything else was behind me was just dying. You know, but like that as a man, I just put on that face and latched onto that physical improvement, and that because everybody could see that, they thought I was doing well, but I wasn't. I was dying to death. Like, you know, it was just horrific. I found it so hard. People who used to look at me respect only a few months earlier, when I was an able person, now looked at me in pity because I was a disability. I was like going, like. I just found that very, very hard to deal with.
And that all goes back to being a man, you know, opening up, man, kind of battle it
Yeah.
in, don't we?
We do, yeah, big time. And I can and that's what I do now. Like, you know, I do my talks and I do my work with the Lighthouse Charity and you know, and that, it's all around that, you know what I mean? Because ultimately if I maybe started talking earlier before I had this accident, you know, my things might have worked out a little bit differently. I just don't want people to go through unnecessary grief or cause unnecessary grief on their family and loved ones by, you know, not by not talking. So that's why I do it, you know, these days because I hid behind that mask for far too long.
Did it take a while for you to, I suppose, for friends to see that you were struggling?
Well, nobody really understood that. Well, no. It was the last week or so before I actually, you know, didn't want to be here. I don't think anybody was seeing that I was struggling because,
Really?
yeah, they thought I was just dealing with the condition. That there's a byproduct of the condition, you know, of being paralyzed and still being in 24/7 nerve pain. And I think they were just thinking, oh yeah, he will get over it. You know what I mean? I don't think people were seeing. Well, I felt nobody saw it. I know that's for sure. Because if they did, I think I would have not gone down the path I did try to go
Yeah.
down. You know, yeah. But again, I like we're the best actors in the world when we want to be, especially men. You know, when we want to, when we don't want to show our suffering and our whole show our weaknesses, we can be the best actors in the world and put on that perfect mask. And I was doing that, you know.
Absolutely. You've done the walk across Ireland not too long after, I suppose. What drove you to do that? Was it to show people that just because you go through these things, you can come out the other side and keep motivated?
Yeah, so there was a lot of things why I did it. Well, number one is I want I so obviously I did try to not be here. I did try to commit suicide.
Yeah.
I was fully committed to it, and luckily I was saved. But after that, you know, I went to the psychiatric ward and I came out through. But inside that psychiatric ward, when I had time to kind of decompress and figure things out in my head without all the other distractions going on around me. I realized I'm personally challenges and competition in my life, simple as. And this is the first time I actually realized this. Everything in my life was all about challenge, like playing for Connacht underage, playing for Irish underage, you know, and so on, building the biggest and best bus business in my area. You know, everything was a challenge. But when I left NRH, when I was in the NRH, my challenge was every day was a day to improve because I didn't know where I was going to be. But 2 weeks before I left NRH, when they gave you the exit plan, I said to my physio, I'm walking out through these doors.
Yeah.
So everything was a challenge. But when I left NRH, all I wanted to do was be home because I've been so long away from my kids, my wife, my friends, my family. But I had no challenge.
Yeah.
Even though I was still going to the gym every day, I didn't deem that as a challenge. It was just something I had to do because it was necessary. And then why I did the walk across the country was because I knew I needed a challenge to focus the mind to give myself a purpose. Number two was obviously to do the challenge I knew would drive me on to train harder, so it would improve my condition as well. So that was number one. Number two was it was a way of thanking the people who stood by me. It was a way of thanking the NRH for all the hard work they put into me and the people in the NRH. And it was also a way of kind of sticking the two fingers up at the world and saying, do you know what? Excuse the expression, but F you, I'm still here and I'm going to beat everything that's put in front of me. So there's, many different things in, going on in that period. It was kind of a two fingers up to the world and saying, you haven't knocked me down yet. I'm still here. It was to thank my friends and family who stuck by me through the thick and thin. It was to thank the people from the NRH, and it was also from my own head because I needed a challenge to refocus the mind and to get going again, to get me out of that negative mindset.
Absolutely. And like obviously it was the for the mind just as in, as well as the physical side of it as
Oh,
well,
yeah.
was it?
Yeah, it was 100%. Yeah, look, for me, look, everything I do now is around the physical exertion, which I find just for movement for me is everything. It keeps me sane, it keeps me occupied, it just gives me energy, and that's why I do take on the challenges these days, because I know that's what I need. Like, I would love to be sitting down and reading 20 books a week, but it's not what does me right, you know what I mean? Because that might suit somebody else, but for me, it's physical activity.
Is there any other challenge that you've kind of a an eye on in the near future that you'd like to do?
Yeah. Well, it's not like I'm like to. I'm going doing it. I'm going walking across America next year in August 2026. Brooklyn
Away.
Bridge, New York. Yeah. Brooklyn Bridge in New York to Santa Monica up here in Los Angeles, or Los Angeles, 4,500 kilometers. I'm going to do it in 60 days. I'm just trying to do 60 kilometers by 75 days. Now, I'm not holding myself to that. If I do it in 80 days, so be it. Whatever it takes, I'm going to do it. And the reason I'm doing the walk is because it's a challenge that I can do, right? But it's also a challenge that anybody of any ability can join me on at any stage. It's not like I'm climbing up a mountain where, only certain somebody of certain ability can do
Yeah.
it, and it's not like I'm going across an ocean. You know what I mean? It's something that anybody of any ability can join me on at any time. And that's why I'm doing it. And
So
it's
that
also
depends for people to kind of join you in stints along the way.
Exactly. Yeah. To join me. I'll be the person who'll do the whole distance, but people can come and join me for 10 meters, 100 meters, 100 miles, whatever they want to do, they're welcome to join me. And that's why I'm doing it. But also, I'm doing it for Spinal Injuries Ireland, because I believe, I was talking earlier on, Ian, about falling off the cliff when I left NRH. I feel there's that gap still left in how to say, in that community, and I'm hope we're hoping to raise close to €1 million to try and fund, their services, so people don't fall off that edge like I did, and
Spinal
they have that
injury
support.
bones,
Yeah.
they're
Yeah.
vital in the afterlife of a spinal injury
Yeah.
as well.
100%. Like, you know what I mean? Like, do they really help you to reintegrate and give you value and purpose to your life again, and to help you when you're just because it's a minefield when you leave. Because when you leave the NRH, you're leaving a place that's geared towards your disability and you're entering into a world that is nowhere near geared to a person with a spinal cord injury abilities,
Absolutely. Before we finish up, Fergus, your new book, Rebuilding a Man, it's a chat about your own story, and what I liked about you hearing you in interviews, you kind of talk about the good and the bad and the mistakes and every part of it, and you said it was important to tell the full story. Where can people, is it out yet, or can they pre-order it, or how's it?
Yeah, Ian, and look, thanks very much for mentioning that. It's out since the 6th of October. You can get it in all good leading big stores as well as local independent stores. It's all over the country in Easons, Dubray, Chapters, independent bookstores, I was saying. And it's also online on Amazon and bookshop.ie and a few other different places like that. So, yeah, and it is, it's a, it's it's a, I've told it as raw as I can. I've kept, I haven't hidden behind my troubles. I haven't glorified my successes. I've just tried to keep it as common and as natural as possible, because you know something, life is that. You know, we have knocks and we've ups and downs and all that type of stuff. And I hope my book shows that, and that you can get through it with the right support around you and the right attitude. You know, no matter what life throws at you, you can get through it.
Like you say, every day is a day to improve.
Exactly, exactly. It is. It really is. And if we can all do that, I think we'll make life a little bit easier on all of us.
Absolutely. Fergus, you're a gent, and I appreciate you coming on now and telling your story. And I know a lot of people know the book, and hopefully people might get onto that and get more in depth into your story. So I appreciate your time this evening.
No, Ian, absolute pleasure. I mean that it's great to be interviewed with somebody who has, you know, a good insight into, and more of an insight into what it is to have a spinal injury and the repercussions. And it's an absolute pleasure.
Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I really appreciate you tuning in as always. A massive thanks to Fergus for coming on tonight and opening up about his own story. Obviously, he went through a lot, and it's great to see where he is now and come out the other side. But I suppose it didn't go without him having his own challenges that are kind of separate from his accident that we talked about as well. So thanks a million to Fergus for coming on. I hope you all enjoyed it and might have learned one or two things off Fergus. So thanks a million to Fergus Farrell. If you have any suggestions, questions or requests before next week's show, you can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or you can send me an email to my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. I hope you're all having a great week so far. Stay tuned in here to Radio Kerry, because Brian Priestley is up next with That's Jazz. I'll be back at the same time next week from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're listening to Standout with Ian O'Connell, Wednesday evenings from 8 p.m. here on Radio Kerry.